Rodgers in trouble. It's going to get there. He turned 32 yesterday. Does he have a vintage moment in it? In the end zone, it is caught for the win. Richard Rodgers with a walk-off touchdown. A game ender for the Packers.
Welcome to the Glass Half Empty podcast on the Big Lead. We're joined by golf legend Greg Norman. Greg owns almost a dozen businesses, and he was made available on behalf of SiriusXM, where he has a new show called Attack Life Radio. It debuted yesterday on the SiriusXM PGA Tour radio channel. Greg, tell us about what this radio show is going to entail.
Very interesting conversational pieces about my life in general, basically a 360 view of what I've seen and experienced and people I've met. To me, I really am looking forward to it. It really started about two and a half years ago where Sirius came to me to ask me if I would do a radio show just specifically on golf. I was not interested in having a conversation about golf in general. I think that would get very boring, show after show after show. So at the end of the day, they were very persistent and persevering with me and working with me to try and understand what I would like to do. And I told them, like I said about 30 seconds ago, I'd like to have a show that I can talk about my life, what I've experienced, the people I've met from leaders of the world to celebrities to famous entrepreneurs to and golfers, of course. So at the end of the day, we decided to do a trial period for 12 months, one show a month, to see how we would go and how I would like to do it and how I would enjoy it going forward. So the first one was yesterday. Three fantastic people on the show, Dustin Johnson, now the new number one, not new, back to being number one in the world, and Brooks Koepka, who's defending his championship at the U.S. Open, and my son, who is very, very close friends with both of those guys. So we had a view, a fireside chat, which is how I like to have my interviews, because that's the way I like to experience interviews with when they've taken place with me over the years of 40-plus years of doing them, is to make them everybody relax and you follow a non-agenda. You just follow, the specific answers, and you give a question off the answer, and that's how it becomes a conversational piece. So I enjoyed it, and I'm pretty sure the guys enjoyed it. So I hope the viewers and listeners enjoyed it as well.
That's cool. I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. If you could do a golf foursome with anybody that you've ever met, and it doesn't necessarily have to be golfers, but it could be golfers, if you could just do it tomorrow for the three other most interesting people you've met, who would it be?
Oh, three interesting people I've met today and do an interview about golf, do an interview about life.
It could be about anything. It doesn't have to be about golf. I mean, I meant, who would you want to play golf with in a foursome tomorrow? They don't have to be golfers. They just have to be really interesting people.
Oh, well, that's easy. I would love to play with Condoleezza Rice. I would love to play with the secretaries of defense from any of the past three or four administrations to play 4.5 rounds with them to understand what the heck is going on in this world. So the golf course is a great place for people to relax, and it's a great place to ask a very simple question that could last for a whole nine holes or 2 hours of playing golf. So interesting people like that. President George Bush, 41, President George Bush, 43, President Clinton, and President Trump. I would love to get them on the golf course as well, too, I know with President Bush, 41, it's his birthday today. Happy birthday to President Bush. But at the end of the day, I would like to just sit down and have a conversation with them, more of a citizen of the world than a politician trying to, back them into a corner and trying to put them on the spot. So things like that, I think that'd be great, because I have been lucky enough to know those gentlemen, and when I do sit down with them, they put their pants on just the same way as everybody else in the world. And you know, they're very open to simple, logical questions about life and the world.
What is something about the wine business that would surprise everybody who drinks wine but isn't in the wine business?
I think to me the beauty of putting something on the table that allows people's palate to say, wow. And specifically, you don't necessarily have to pair up a wine to enjoy a wine. For example, my Cab Sav Reserve, you can have it with a full-blown pizza. And it just really ignites all the flavors in the wine. So being adventurous, and if you like to enjoy wine, you can have a glass of wine at lunch, you know, like a Riesling or... you know, then at dinner you can just move into something else. And so it's really exploring your own palate and exploring your own desires what to do with wine. I don't, I'm not a guy who's stuck in the box and just think about, okay, this is where it's supposed to be. I'm the opposite. I try to get out of the box and just give people experiences that they would like to choose themselves.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, like, from the kind of, like, procurement process to distribution to whatever else, what is something that is surprising about the business aspect of making and distributing wine?
Well, for me, I'm very, very fortunate. I have a great partner in Treasury Wine Estate. They're the ones we buy the grapes off. I mean, I have two winemakers, and we acquire the grapes off of out of their vineyard. And then in the process, we bottle it. It's obviously labeled Greg Norman Estate. And then we use their distribution arm to get it out there to the world. So it's a very, very seamless joint venture relationship, and it's worked extremely well for 20 years now. And then people looked at us in the beginning and as a celebrity wine, but we have stood the test of time and the distribution and the expansion. So at the end of the day, we aren't a celebrity wine. We're a quality wine that delivers at the right price and over-delivers on the quality of the wine.
In your businesses, like a million different things must come up every day. How much of your day is planned versus how much of it is addressing something that comes up spontaneously in the capacity of your work life?
Oh, look, the latter part of your question, I do that every day. Every day there's something that comes up. Every day you have to address something. Every day you might have to put out a fire. There might be a decision you need to make and a quick email you need to read and an answer you've got to give to your people back home. Like now I'm in Colorado and I'm not back in my office, so on a daily basis I must speak to my office 3, 4, 5 times a day. And that's important because you want your executives to be out there doing their thing, but at the same time, sometimes they have a question and they need an answer. You know, so it's I stay in touch. Sometimes I get a little bit too much in the weeds, but that's my nature. As a professional golfer, I really drill down on a lot of things that I needed to work on personally in my life on the golf course. So I stayed focused on it. So I get into the minutiae of things, and I'm trying to wean myself off of that because I got a fantastic group of people now that I absolutely 101% trust, and so at the end of the day, if they need me to give them a little bit of guidance on what and a question they have on a given day, then I'm there for them.
You mentioned putting out fires. Is there any kind of explosion that you ever had to put out that you could tell us about?
Not really, no explosion. I mean, there's always something that. It's not necessarily internal. Sometimes it comes from external. Sometimes there might be something happening. For example, putting together a schedule to go to Australia. You have to do ROT, return on time. So I work very, very closely with my EA, Anna Silverman. I work very, very closely with my chief operating officer and my senior vice president of Gold Course Design, who handles that part of the world. But it takes months and months and months to work because, you know, there's a lot of PR things. So I have to work with my director of corporate communications, Jay McNeil. So I've got to get everybody together on the same page to make sure that the schedule that we want to do for August or November, whether it's Australia, whether it's Vietnam, that all the right things are in place where there is great ROT on my behalf. Instead of just going over there just to go over there, you have to really drill down, refine meetings, refine PR initiatives, refine media, and make sure they get established and executed on. So when you come away from there, you go, okay, now we've built on that, then we're going to be able to continue on, and there might be something new we can come out of it. And so that's how you build on your business.
A few years ago, you had a big intellectual property dispute in China. Could you give the cliff notes on that and say what you learned from the kind of harrowing experience?
Well, look, I think the media in general has covered a little bit about how China has really taken it to the cleaners with United States companies. I'm a very, very small part of that. I did experience the fact that they stole my intellectual property without my permission. And they went out there and, China being China, they just continued on doing it. And I actually sued them. And it took, I think, about 3.5 years, something like that, to actually win my IP back, which I should never have lost. So it was a monumental task to do it. It cost me a lot of money to do it. But at the end of the day, you have to protect what you own and what you know is yours, and you have to protect your future. So I undertook the task. It wasn't pleasant. It was very tedious. Fighting the Chinese law firm was very, very difficult because of not only the language barrier, but the legal barriers and the legal setups and how you got to understand how they implement it is different from what happens in the United States or Australia or in the Western world. So it was an education process. You don't want to see that happen to any company anywhere in the world, because no different than what happens with, today with the G7 summit. Fair trade and fair tariffs should be the same for everybody. And this is, you sit across the table, you negotiate, and why not have reciprocal tariffs? Or why not just eliminate tariffs? Or just have a flat 10% or 15% tariff for every country all around the world, to make it even for everybody. That's the simple way of doing it, and that's the business way of doing it, and just eliminate what happened in the past.
You've spoken about wanting to create a company that lasts for 200 years. How do you go about, in 2018, setting up a brand that can outlast you both as somebody who is overseeing it and is the face and figurehead of all of the different ventures that you guys are part of?
Well, that's foundational. In the beginning, going back in the beginning to 1992-93, when I first decided to venture into the business world and own my own business and look after my own branding and marketing, you had to understand what it was all about, and branding and marketing is not a simple thing. Unfortunately for me, I had a fantastic logo that was developed by then, at that time, Reebok, and I understood branding and marketing. So I started to build a foundation that was purely based on golf, and as it developed over a period of time, 20-plus years, that foundation became very solid and allowed me to broaden my horizon. And as I broaden my horizons, you get away from sports-related marketing to into a B2B-type marketing, and that's where I am today. So as you develop these businesses will eventually run on in perpetuity without me, because of the foundation underneath them has been so solid and so direct, and with really good human resources managing the process. And that is what I go through today. And for me to change gears from a sports marketing company into a B2B company, I had to change human resources, because at the end of the day, you have to have like-minded people who can see out 12 years, see out 200 years. And in any business, it's no different than what you see out there with Henri Lacoste or Ralph Lauren, even though he's still around. Those businesses will live on in perpetuity because of the foundation they've established from their infancy. And that's where I am today, and I've been now for basically 25 years, so I've got a pretty good head start.
In the Great White Shark Opportunity Fund, you guys lend money to mid-size and small-size companies. Are there any companies that you've invested in that are outside of the Greg Norman umbrella that have grown to become really big businesses that we would have heard of now?
We've invested in a few, but they haven't grown into really big businesses as yet. Probably the most important one that I've invested in with my partner right now is Shark Experience. We've taken 4.5 years to develop a model, find the right partners like Verizon and Club Car and GPSI, partner up with great institutions like the PGA Tour. We have now taken the 4.5 years of building the model out to execution phase now. Where March the 1st, we are actually implementing, putting a screen on every club car that comes off their production line this year. And it'll go on when fully deployed. We'll be in front of 93 million golfers on an annual basis. But my partner and I are investing in owning the screens that we put on each cart, and those screens that go on those carts are accompanied by speakers built into the roof, so you can get live streaming sport, you can get live streaming music, you can get news, finance, whatever you want to do. Our mantra is your game, your way. And instead of taking your device to the golf course, now it's all built into the screen. And my partner and I pretty much own the content. We partnered up with Verizon and Club Car, and it's never been done before. It was Virgin Space sitting there, and we just decided to capitalize on it. And here we are today, 4.5 years later. We've started March the 1st.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the Shark Experience within the lens of it's impossible to ignore. There have been so many stories about the decline in youth participation rate in golf. Do you think that something like this smart golf course that allows you to stream video and music while on the course is something that could help curb that trend?
Well, we believe so. We believe we're part of the change with the negative trend to date. But there are other changes that need to take place as well, too. And we've had validation through our advisory board, the USGA, the PGA of America, the major management companies that do private golf courses and public golf courses. These individuals out there who speak to the operators on a day-to-day basis are crying out for something new, something that can be accretive to their bottom line. For example, Shark Experience is going to be allowing revenue to flow through to the operator, which I don't recall too many other opportunities golf course operators have had in the past where they get revenue from sharing an experience like we have with Shark Experience. So I grew up as an assistant pro, and I saw how hard it was for my club pro Charlie Earp to really scrape out a living out of a pro shop. So any time that I could find a way to add to the revenue to an operator, it was important to me, and I've done that. And people are now starting to see that. Operators are starting to experience that. And as they understand Shark Experience more and more and more, they'll understand at the end of the day that it's going to be very, very accretive to their business. So that excites me tremendously. And getting back to your question about the millennials, whatever we can do to give kids today snackable content to allow them to get out there and enjoy and experience something, you can do that. I had a gentleman who experienced Shark Experience just recently, and he gave a great testimonial. He said, I've been trying to get my son out onto the golf course to experience 4 hours being with me on a golf course, but I could never do that. He would take his iPad or his iPhone out there, but it would die. The battery would die after an hour and a half or 2 hours, and the kid would want to go home. He said, now my son, even though he doesn't want to play golf for 18 holes, he actually is there for 4 hours, 4.5 hours with me because he can look at the screen, he can listen to his music, he can do what he wants to do, and that was really important messaging for his father to experience the time with his son. So there's a little baby step. A journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step, and if that is, starts the trend out there and people start to see that, feel that, you know, we've achieved a little bit of the goal of introducing the millennials to a different way of playing the game of golf.
I'm not sure if this has been written about comprehensively or not, but I feel like country clubs, at least in America, are going to be in some trouble. I don't think that they're all going to go away, per se, but a lot of them are going to have to switch from being private to being public courses if they're going to endure. Do you agree with that sentiment, or do you disagree?
I disagree to a hybrid version. Yes, obviously, you know, when the GFC hit pretty hard, disposable income dried up a little bit. So when disposable income dries up, golf suffers because you've got to pay your annual dues. You've got to pay certain things to be a member of a golf club. So when people go through a little bit of hardship, they start to cut that off and turn the tap off to try and save disposable income. So at the end of the day, yes, some of them fell on the wayside. We saw a reduction in the number of golf courses, specifically here in the United States. But that's going to bottom out because there will always be 23 to 27 million golfers, hopefully, in the United States who want to continue to play golf. The demographics are going to move through. The baby boomers are going to move through. Then the millennials, they'll come through this process. And as long as we can educate them the value of what golf and golf courses can give to them, we'll keep that average of 23, 24 to 27 million golfers in the United States. So, but yes, the hybrid version is, okay, golf courses are a great amenity. Golf courses are a great experience. Golf courses allow people from a residential development community, from a resort. So there are other incredible opportunities for the game of golf to flatten out and start to grow in the near future.
Yeah, I just look at it from the perspective of when my parents were my age. I'm 31 years old. They belonged to a country club. And I was racking my brain. I think I know thousands of people, and I don't know anybody my age at this point who is a country club member yet. So I don't know if that's something that's just going to get delayed until maybe late 30s, early 40s, or if my peers are just never going to join them.
Look, I mean, that's an interesting look at it. From my perspective, the country clubs will always be there because at the end of the day, it's changing the evolution of the country club. What it was 25 years ago to 30 years ago when you were just born is different what we're looking at today and looking into the future. Country clubs now are more of a hospitality club. They're more family-orientated. They give a lot more back. You just don't have to be a member of a country club just to play golf. You can be a member of a country club and enjoy a lot of other amenities that have been bolted on today. So all, when we in the golf course design business, we actually design, country club hospitality and other amenities in our design philosophy because that's what the owner or the developer wants. So it's a very fluid situation, and not everybody wants everything. Some people might just want a golf course, period, end of that, and they just want 200 members, and they just want to have an ultra-private and ultra-exclusive. That's fine. That works, too. So at the end of the day, it's a very fluid situation where we make the adjustments and we make the suggestions to the developer to say, hey, this is what we've seen. We've opened 104 golf courses around the world. We have another 44 under contract, and this is what we're seeing, experiencing, and these are the things we can advise you on and implement to help your investment into whatever you're going to do, whether it's a country club or not, to help your investment become your return on investment is far superior than what you actually ever anticipated. So we become a bit of an advisor to the future, and I actually enjoy that because we see so many different opportunities all around the world. We see the tremendous growth of the game of golf in Vietnam now, for example. we see growth in the game of golf back here in the United States starting to pick up again. We see it in Mexico. We see it in Australia, in the Far East. It's just incredible. And in the Middle East. So we've had a lot of touch points and understanding of the different nuances that are making golf becoming more and more popular around the world.
Switching gears a little bit, you're a big adventurer. Let's say somebody comes to you and is like, okay, I've got 3 weeks. This is a really rare occasion, but I've got 3 weeks to take a vacation. Where in the world should I go? What's your answer?
Well, it depends on how fit you are. What are you looking for? What are you looking just to lay on the beach, just chill out for 3 weeks and read books? There's a plethora of great places around the world you can go to, from the Great Barrier Reef to the Caribbean, the U.S. Virgin Islands, British Virgin Islands. You can go to the Maldives. There's so many fantastic places around the world you can go to. You can go to Bali. You can go to Phuket. There's places in the Far East which are stunningly beautiful. You can go to Micronesia. If you're just looking for that specific getaway in time for 3 weeks, great. I had a fantastic trip with my wife to Chile. We went to Atacama, the driest part of the world in the northern part of Chile. Then we went down and spent time in Patagonia, just hiking glaciers and doing that. But we're very fit and adventurous people. We hiked a volcano to 19,000 feet, overlooking Chile and Bolivia. Those are the type of things that I like. If I personally wanted to do a trip, I would go down to dive under the Antarctic ice pack, which I've never done before. And so that would be on my number one on my bucket list to do. So they're adventurous things, and you have to be very aware of your own body and your own senses and your own desires and your own limitations to be able to go and execute on things like that. And then there are other fun things you can do, too, just exploring great cities around the world, too, going to impressive boutique hotels that people don't really see on a regular basis because they're off the radar screen, but there's some magnificent little boutique hotels that I've experienced and seen. So it really depends on what you're looking for and what you want to come away with. If you want to come away with a great experience, great. If you want to just come away with being totally relaxed in a zen mode, you can do that as well too.
What are your 5 favorite cities in the world?
I would have to say I love London. I like Chicago.
I live in Chicago.
I like Sydney. I like Melbourne. I think Cape Town's a pretty cool little town. I shouldn't say little, but I'd say like Cape Town. Hong Kong, the big buzz and atmosphere around Hong Kong, full of character, full of personality. Places like that, I would say.
I'm pumped that Chicago made your list. Okay, so before we get you out of here, we got to talk about the U.S. Open this weekend. First of all, what are your impressions of the Shinnecock course?
Well, I've been consistent in saying this. I think Shinnecock is one of my favorite golf courses in the world, for sure. And I think, as far as I'm concerned, it's the hardest, fairest golf course on the planet. What I mean by that is, if Shinnecock wasn't even being prepared for the U.S. Open, you could go there in a month from now, or you could go there in a year from now, and you could actually have a PGA Tour event there. That's how good Shinnecock is. It's an incredible layout. It tests all 14 clubs in your bag. It tests you physically. It tests you mentally. And outside of all that, the element of what Long Island could do is just incredible from the morning to the afternoon. It could be a very heavy wind that's coming off the Atlantic. Everything changes about the golf course over a period of 8 to 10 hours as the sun rises to the sun sets. So the player has to be very, very in tune with his game, very in tune with himself. And then you add on the fact that it's a U.S. Open, which magnifies everything to a degree. So I think it's going to be I don't know how the USGA has set it up. I've just read a few little tidbits about it. But at the end of the day, Shinnecock is going to be a golf course that can defend itself extremely well.
What are your thoughts on how Tiger Woods is playing in his latest comeback?
You know. Obviously, he's done a good job of getting back, but I really don't pay any attention to Tiger Woods. I think there are so many other great players out there that deserve the attention and the focus, and they step up to the plate week in, week out. There's probably 12 to 16 guys that I like to follow more than Tiger Woods, but that's because they're the young generation. They're the new kids coming through. They're the Jordan Spieths, the Justin Thomas of the world, the Ricky Fowlers of the world, the Dustin Johnsons, the Brooks Koepkas, you know. Those are kids that Rory McIlroy. You know, there's a plethora of great young players that I think are better today than watching Tiger Woods.
If you had to pick a winner this weekend, who would it be?
Well, coming off his performance last week on a golf course that I know well, I would say Dustin Johnson. He's driving the ball exceptionally well. And if he doesn't have to use the driver, he's got his driving iron. He can hit out there 260 to 280 yards any time he wants. So keeping the ball in play is going to be important. And it's very difficult to follow up a win with a major win. But at the end of the day, with his confidence and his attitude and his demeanor, I really like, today I really like his chances coming Sunday afternoon.
Is there anything that we didn't talk about either with golf or business or adventures that you wish that I had asked and that you want to talk about right now?
Well, there's probably a lot, but conversations can go on for a long period of time, Ryan. So at the end of the day, I think we've pretty much covered everything.
Thank you so much, Greg. Really appreciate your time. Know it's at a premium. Check out Greg's new show on SiriusXM, PGA Tour Radio, Attack Life Radio. He's going to be talking about his zeal for living and entrepreneurial spirit. Once again, thank you again, Greg. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ryan, and good luck with your show, too.
Great. Thank you.